talk for ages then.
So what are we doing? Are we filling or are we cutting, Pierre?
No, we're carrying on.
We're filling.
You can come back in and join in.
No time for that.
Okay. All right. And just make sure you go before we start next time, Jamie. Jamie, eh? What a... No.
Unbelievable.
Okay. Hello and welcome to another telecoms.com podcast. I'm joined this week as ever by Jamie, and we're exchanging one light reading person for another in the form of Ian, who's back from whatever you've been doing. And just to remind you that if you're watching this on the site or on Facebook, you can also listen to it on SoundCloud or iTunes, and vice versa. Can I just pre-record this and we could just play it every time? Just superimpose a different t-shirt.
Maybe.
Anyway, and if you're listening to it, you can watch it on the site or on Facebook. Okay, so this week we are going to start off by talking about convergence, obviously in the telecom space, but also involving content. Then we're then going to move on to China crisis, or as people were urging me to call it on account of my t-shirt, Chinese democracy. And then we're going to finish with a little look at Amazon and how well it's doing. So to start off with, on the convergence side of things, there have been one or two stories this week where we're just looking at big companies that are looking to combine interests in sort of telecoms and networks and providing communication services, but also providing content. And Jamie, you were writing about Sky's numbers today, so why don't you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, they just done very well. 5% year-on-year growth up to like 10 billion for the first 9 months of 2018-2017,
yeah,
this financial year. And to be honest, they're looking like a convergence giant, just sort of like lurking in the shadows at the moment. I know they're, you know, they've had their broadband offering for a long time, then they've just launched their mobile offering last year, and obviously they are the dominant pay TV player. Turn your phone off, Ian.
That's just bad pod etiquette, isn't it?
And we'll put it on silent at least. And then, you know, they are the dominant pay TV player in the UK market. But they're just looking just incredibly, incredibly secure.
Okay.
And I think if you're going to go one, you mentioned it there, if you're going to go from one direction in terms of convergence.
Good band reference.
Yeah. you'd maybe start not off in content, and you'd want to move over to the communication services.
Is that what you reckon?
Yeah, because I think it's just so, so difficult to get content right.
Yeah.
It, very, really, really difficult. But, you know, launching an MVNO, which is what they've done last year, you've got rid of all the network complications. They don't have to build or manage their own network because they've just got this MVNO agreement with, I don't know who.
No, I'm not sure who they're.
I think
provider is.
For some reason, I think it's EE because Virgin Media is with Vodafone. So for some reason, I think it's EE, or it might be O2.
Kind of weird if it wasn't EE, wouldn't it, in a way, with all the argy bargy between.
Oh, maybe it's
BT
not.
And Sky. Although, no, because Sky obviously uses BT for fixed line services. So
there's lots of co-opetition, whatever we call it.
But yeah, so they've taken out all the networking, a huge amount of the networking problems anyway, so they can focus on customer service on the top end and getting their tariffs right. And then when you look at the broadband side of things, they're not rolling out their own network either. They're very much relying on a wholesale relationship with Openreach.
Yep.
So as much as some people are some people in the industry are moaning that Openreach isn't doing enough,
that Sky is often the most vocal.
Yes, yeah. Well, it's like, I suppose so. You're taking that networking complication out of it as well. So, you know, all they've got to rely on really, and I know I'm dumbing this down massively because there will be a lot of networking problems, all they're relying on really, or a lot of it, is customer service, you know, getting the right, creating the right experience on top, and you know, that's the best way to do it, I see, because no one in the telco game has really managed to put together any form of competent content offering as it stands.
No, so I suppose the big comparison would be BT. So there, you're talking about a company that started off being a sort of content sort of distributor, and you know, I think their big business model in terms of content was just paying like crazy for Premier League football and that sort of thing. And then
I don't know. I mean, like the movies is a big. is a bit has, yeah, fair was point. A big draw,
but they're still
for
a distributor and suppose yeah, they're not making their own movies. And then used the fact that they then had a massive presence in everyone, in a lot of people's living rooms, and a massive sort of billing relationship with them to sort of expand that billing relationship to sort of a communication services. And you're saying that that's probably the best way of doing it. I'm not saying you're wrong, but I'm thinking out loud about coming out the other way. So I suppose that's BT in the UK.
Yeah.
So we're already a massive sort of communications provider. And now we're trying to get into content. And, you know, this illustration would seem to bear your point out, because BT seems to have struggled to be a competitive content provider and to get ROI on what it's spent on football and that sort of thing. So I'll just ask you, and what do you think? Do you think there is a sort of optimum way to go at this sort of communication / content convergence, or is it just on a case-by-case basis?
I think Sky's quite an unusual case, I think. I don't know if there are that many other examples of companies that had that sort of strong pay TV position in, a European market and then decided to kind of go charging into broadband and, MVNO stuff. I mean, I suppose you've got the cable companies that, have been in the TV and the broadband game. Organizations like Liberty and everything.
Yeah.
You could say they're content companies as well, but I don't know. I mean, BT, you know, which you talked about, has sort of come unstuck, I think, because it's sort of put all of its eggs in one basket, really, hasn't it? It's gone after the sports side of things in a very
really
big way,
expensive.
Which is incredibly costly. Yeah. And I mean, we were BT TV subscribers in the Morris household, and there's not a lot else to the TV service apart from sport, apart from the football. There's various other bits and pieces you get from rugby, but in terms of movies or there's no equivalent of Sky Atlantic or anything like that. And I think with the rise of the sort of pure web content companies like Netflix and Prime, it's just made things extremely hard for an organisation like BT in the last few years, whereas Sky has still got quite a sort of broad offering. It's got the sport, but it's also got its investments in, I mean, Game of Thrones, for example, must have been a huge draw for Sky over the last few years, because it's been the only kind of channel you've been able to get it on.
It's what made us subscribe to Now TV.
Exactly.
Like just as a sort of one-off thing. We don't subscribe to Sky full on. But
it's on Prime now.
It's on Prime now.
Oh, right.
Maybe not everything, but some of it is on Prime.
Right. Yeah, well, we're going to come back to Prime.
But the thing is that in the same, you kind of wonder about the regulatory landscape as well, because in the same way that BT's always taken a bit of a hammering on the broadband side and the network side for not being, you know, according to competitors, good enough at sorting faults out and good enough at providing, you know, access to infrastructure.
Well, not good enough according to consumers as well. The recent Ofcom numbers had BT about the most moaned about company.
Yeah. And that's led to more heavy regulation, obviously, including the kind of legal separation of Openreach. And BT's big issue has always been that Sky's too sort of monopolistic in the content market, and it can't get access to wholesale deals with Sky at favourable rates. So, you know, there's a question there, I guess, about whether, you know, whether it's fair to kind of weigh in heavily on BT.
Yeah,
where they've
and
done
one tough one,
on Sky.
It occurred to me when you're talking about the sport, you know, Sky's business model way back, I don't know, 20 years ago, whenever it started paying like crazy for Premier League, was to have all of it.
Yeah.
Was to be, so if you're a bloke who really needs his fix of footy on a Saturday afternoon, you had no choice. Whereas, you know, you can get pretty decent highlights on BBC right now.
Yep. It's become more fragmented.
Yeah, you've got BT, you've got other sources, you presumably there are sort of VOD options cropping up. So then when you don't have that particular segment of the market completely owned, I think your ability to sort of cash in on it is much smaller. And I think that was, in hindsight, always going to be the case with BT, where they're only ever going to get a minority of the coverage.
Yeah.
There's not enough critical mass to make it a no-brainer to sort of subscribe to them to get hold of that footy.
But this is the difference between communication services and content, in that it's, you know, Our definition of a good experience when we're using our phone is, do we get good download speeds? Are we charged correctly? Does my phone switch on? If there's something wrong with the phone, we generally blame the operator.
Yeah.
you know, that's easy to do. It's not easy to do, but it's very scientific. It's very black and white. When you go into the content game, you know, you for instance, like take music or sports, it's very difficult to create a good experience for all three of us. You know, we have varied interests, we have different objectives when it comes to actual content. So providing a good experience there is an immensely complicated task, because there's no, you know, it works, it doesn't work. The nuances of content make it so much more difficult. And this is where I think Sky have been very, very good over the last couple of years. Their content is so varied. You know, you look at, like, I never watch the music channels anymore, but I used to watch the music channels when I was younger. It's got kids' content, it's got movies, it's got box sets, it's got a partnership with HBO. It's, you know, just announced partnerships with Netflix and, or just cemented down partnerships with Netflix and Spotify. It's got its own original content, it's got terrestrial channels, it's got something that keeps everyone happy.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas what, you know, BT, if you don't like sports, you don't really like BT.
Not BT's content, sorry. No, I think you're right, and I think they've sort of matured their business model in the past, just like other people's business model. Like, for example, Microsoft's evolved from just sort of trying to flog box software to this sort of SaaS and cloud model. You know, they've realised that the era of just being able to rinse football-addicted blokes for 100 quid a month is gone. And they need to be a bit more subtle and sophisticated and bespoke about what they're offering. So I think you're right.
It's interesting because, you know, you hear from the US a lot that the content companies, the big cable companies, have really struggled in the era of Amazon Prime and Netflix, and been losing, you know, cutting the cord. I think it's like a US expression, isn't it, for people ditching those services and just going completely over the top. But Sky seems to have kind of bucked that trend to some extent, and it kind of shows what good content it's got. You know, whatever you say about Sky and whatever your view is of the company, they have, you know, they have these deals with, like as Jamie mentioned, HBO. They have the football. They have enough to keep customers coming back for more. No one's ever going to ditch a, no TV fan would ever ditch a Sky subscription to get a BT one, really.
No. I mean, this is where I see the real value for operators, in that, I mean, Sky, I think, is heading that direction. But if you could pay for all your, I don't know, I know it's going to be an immensely complicated way to set it up, but if you could pay for all your OTT services through your Sky subscription, you know, like you do on Now TV when you buy like a movie pass, for instance, or you have all of these OTTs in like a single a single window, so you can access it all through your Sky box. I think that's the perfect business model for operators. You know, being that aggregator.
Yeah, I agree. One other thing I'm curious to sort of explore on the back of our speculation about which direction it's best to approach convergence from is looking at the big US operators, specifically AT&T and Verizon, and how they've spent a lot of money. AT&T wants to spend a lot of money on acquiring Time Warner, which is, of course, the owner of HBO and hence Game of Thrones and all this good stuff. I wonder, people have been speculating ever since the bid was announced. I just wonder what they're going to do with it. Because Jamie and I were laughing in the office. We're talking about how, you know, I'm such a big fan of HBO. Ever since Sopranos, The Wire, Deadwood, it's just an incredibly high quality of drama. And completely indicative of the creative people just being left to do their creative thing.
Yep.
There obviously isn't some suit poking his nose in, going, why isn't there more product placement or whatever? Or if he is, he's doing it very subtly.
Yeah.
But what, you know, what if AT&T finally completes the acquisition of Time Warner and then sticks some AT&T suit in? At the head of HBO and starts dicking about.
You'd have
with
to
the
hope that they're
process.
Sensible enough not to do that, and they realise that it's a successful model and that they shouldn't interfere with it. I mean, I think that deal is a bit of an odd one in a way, because it's such a massive amount to spend, and, you know, I mean, if they can already get access to this stuff and provide it to customers anyway, in the way that Sky has a deal with HBO here, then why do they need control of it necessarily, unless they feel that, I don't know, ownership would suit them better commercially? But this is one of the things that's prompted regulatory concern, isn't it? Because there's worry that they'll somehow try to restrict access.
Yes. Because otherwise, why bother if you're
well,
not
going to
try that?
This is what I don't get, is you know, what's the rationale for doing it unless you want to prevent Verizon, the rivals, from having Game of Thrones?
But they'd never get away with that, even if the deal went through and they tried that.
Exactly.
I'm sure regulators would then go, well, hold on a minute.
I mean, they say it's all about putting content on mobile devices, don't they? That's the big thing, is to, you know, have deals where they can more easily bundle Game of Thrones with a monthly subscription. But I don't really see what the barrier to doing that would be beforehand if they have a commercial deal with HBO.
I'd like to see data on sort of VOD consumption on mobile phones. If I'm honest, I see when I get the train into London, I see a few people watching stuff on their phones. Mm. It never particularly appeals to me, to be honest. I mean, I'll do it sometimes, like if I'm on a long haul flight and I'm desperately bored.
Yeah,
I've got all the series of Red Dwarf just stored on my phone, and that's always a good one to fall back on. But it's not my first choice at all. I'll get through tablets, I'll get through the plane telly and all that stuff before I start resorting to my phone. What are you, Jamie? Do you ever watch like telly or video stuff on your phone?
No, generally on my phone. I mean, first of all, my commute's quite short, so don't have to worry about that.
What about when you're going back home?
I generally take my laptop with me, to be honest with you. So, I mean, this is the one complaint I have on Now TV. Maybe there is a way to do it, but I haven't actually found it. But you can't download. So in the same way, like, so BBC, get the BBC app on your laptop and you can download any episode and you don't have to be hooked up to any form of connectivity to watch it.
And that's the what Now people TV tend to do on the train, isn't it?
They
great download on the train. It first, yeah.
Yeah, but Now TV, there's no way to...
Is that a rights issue, maybe?
Or? I don't know, but see, you can't I know download
it's,
it.
It's very awkward to do that with some Amazon programs as well, and... I don't know if you can do it with all Netflix stuff.
Yeah, maybe it is. Maybe I just didn't think about that.
But then certainly if you travel abroad, then all of a sudden you encounter all these big problems. You're trying to watch occasionally I have my laptop, you know, on a business trip, and you think you don't want to go out that evening, just sit in your room and watch another episode of Sopranos, whatever it might be, or whatever's out at the moment, and you can't get it because all of a sudden you're in
VPN. Yeah, and they're supposed to be working on that, aren't they?
VPN don't work.
No? I never tried it.
Not the free ones.
No? Well, there's supposed to be sorting that out in Europe, aren't they? You're supposed to have the right to move yours.
Yeah.
But as ever with Europe, but, you know,
it's
don't hold your breath.
Quickly,
I think I read somewhere or heard somewhere that they were getting better at allowing these sort of brief downloads. I presume it comes down to sort of DRM technology, like how can they protect themselves from you actually saving and copying and pirating the file. But if they get a DRM right such that the thing, you know, like a Snapchat message or whatever, just auto-destructs after a day...
Yeah. Yeah.
Then it should be doable. So I imagine that will happen. But yeah, I agree that AT&T one's still struggling with that, and it's such a lot of money as well.
Wasn't there something in the news about that today? AT&T and Time Warner.
Yeah, they got
their
CEO.
Time Warner was in front of the regulators, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was up yesterday, and I think the Randall Stevenson, whatever it is slated to go up today.
Right. Trying to put their case forward.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just going to drag on and on and on.
It's already dragged on for a fair amount of time.
I mean, to
it?
Be honest, like the judge has already said a few times that, you know, he doesn't... The equations and the algorithms that the government have used to show how you know, devastating this would be to the actual economy or the ecosystem, he said they're a bit sketchy.
Yeah.
So it looks like the judge is leaning towards... saying, yeah, you can do it.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how political it is, because we'll come on to this when we talk about sort of Chinese vendors. But, you know, Trump, and in fact, we might well come on to it when we talk about Amazon, because these are both areas in which Trump's been poking his nose in. And he's also said some quite public things about AT&T, I think, either since or before he became president.
But their concern is interesting in a way, isn't it? Looking at coming back to Sky, because what they're worried about AT&T doing post a Time Warner acquisition is effectively what Sky does now, and this is what BT complains about, is that it can't get it has to open its Open Reach network, still part of the BT group obviously, and all of that, but it can't get Game of Thrones, it can't get some of the sports channels that they have.
And then we get the eternal problem of regulators trying to play catch up with these very sharp business people.
Yes.
One thing I'll say, just to sort of round off, there are a couple of other things that spring to mind that I've written about this week that sort of at least slightly overlap. With BT, one thing I think is quite interesting is there seems to be a growing number of former EE people getting senior executive positions within BT.
Mm.
So Mark Alero, who was the head of EE,
he's head of consumer now.
He's head of all consumer. Yeah. And then they've just appointed a guy called McQuaid.
Yeah, I saw that this week.
To head up an enlarged B2B division.
Yeah.
And then I also recently found out that another EE guy has been made head of mobile. It's like, it's more junior in these positions, but still quite still executive, head of mobile for BT Sport.
Mm.
A bloke called Matt Stagg.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing I take from it is I know that culturally EE and BT are pretty different.
Yeah.
And I know that it wasn't easy, as is often the case, you know. We could talk about it, couldn't we?
Yeah.
It took a while for our culture to merge, didn't it, Ian?
Yeah.
Have we merged? With M&A. Has it yet? I just make you sit on the podcast every now and then. That with M&A, you can have these sort of cultural things that are often a bit of an afterthought and everyone's just left to sort it out.
Yeah.
But what seems to be happening is that Gavin Hasselhoff, strike through Patterson, is going, actually, these EE guys seem a bit more with it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it seems like more than a coincidence that so many of them are getting there. So that's one little bit of news talking about BT. And then on the sort of convergence and regulatory side, just one other thing I was writing about today and Jamie wrote about earlier on the week is Telecom Italia, or TIM, to its mates. TIM is being hassled by another bloke called Elliot, which is a sort of active investor organisation. And Elliot's poking its nose in because Vivendi, as we've spoken about on the pod before, has been trying this sort of stealth takeover without actually buying the whole company, just by sticking all its lads on the board. And Elliot's come in and gone, nah, less of that. And now there's just this sort of massive proxy sort of battle of wills between the two of them.
Yeah.
And
the Italian government's involved now.
Government's aware, so because it's a former state monopoly, isn't it?
Well, they bought a 5% stake.
Yeah, right. CDP.
And they're kind of allied with Elliot. So
right.
They're kind of in cahoots with Elliot.
I don't understand it. I mean, it's just going to destroy Tim. Like,
what is Elliot? If Elliot gets his way.
If they,
not much to destroy.
Well, I mean, at the moment,
they're not doing badly at the moment, actually.
Yeah, they're doing all right at the moment. And they've got a decent mobile brand. They've got fixed assets, and with Vivendi, they've got ambitions to, you know, to go into the content world. It's all this sort of digi Tim. So long term, they've got this great idea for convergence, and then all of a sudden, you've got Elliot that comes along and he says, "Right, we want to reintroduce the dividend, which will take away from CapEx in the long run." To reintroduce the dividends, they'd have to also sell off a load of assets. So that would be selling off their smaller mobile assets. And also, instead of just spinning out Netco, their fixed assets, into a wholly owned separate entity, they want to sell off 50 to 100% of the actual business. So they just want to gut Tim. You know, it's pure pump and dump share. Sort of strategy, and in 5 years' time, if Elliot gets it its way, what is going to be left of Tim? It's not going to have any physical assets, which a lot of companies are trying to expand at the moment. So look at what Vodafone's doing, Virgin Media's trying to do the same. Everyone's trying to get fiber into their business, and all it's going to be is just, you know, an OTT content provider and a. And a mobile
brand. Maybe that
brand.
Suits Vivendi more as well if they're just trying to build a media business. And
yeah, but they still want the scale. They still want. I mean, they still want, you know, the opportunity to launch products and you know, the ability to sort of control the market to a degree.
Yeah.
And also the other thing is, if you look at financing, if you're a hollowed out machine and you've only got an OTT sort of content brand and a pretty weak mobile brand in the future, you know, getting more financing off the government, approaching banks, if you haven't got these huge assets to put against these sort of investments, you're not going to look very attractive to other people.
I find the whole Vivendi strategy quite weird, to be honest, because there's all this stuff about, I mean, I don't think that company's ever really known what it wants to do and what it wants to be. You know, how it defines itself. Well, in the past, you know, I mean, I got into the telecom sector, you know, back at the sort of turn of the century when they were very much a telecom player, you know, trying to get into that, and then it was more about being a media company
Universal.
Trying to build this Southern European sort of rival to Netflix. But I don't see any evidence of them doing anything at Telecom Italia to make it a kind of content company or to take it in a kind of convergence direction. I mean, all this stuff that's been happening in the last year that the guy, you know, I can't even remember his name, but the former CEO who Genish replaced.
Because
his surname began with C, He did a really good job, but in terms, that was all about infrastructure. It was all about getting more fiber out. It was all about trying to get trying to get the mobile network into shape. You know, all those investments that they've announced over the past few years have all gone into sort of infrastructure improvements. And I don't see, Vivendi's got a stake in Mediaset as well, which is kind of Berlusconi's Italian.
Yeah.
But that seems to be just as much of a kind of hot potato.
Haven't they been forced to sell that though?
They still have a stake in it.
Yeah, but it wasn't there something that came out a couple of days ago that said you got to get rid of that?
Right, maybe. But that's the point, isn't it? That's just as much of a hot potato as the opera, and that surely would be the place to start if you're trying to build some kind of content king down in Italy.
I mean,
it's all very messy and confusing, really. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, you look at what sort of Vivendi in the last sort of 2 years have been about. It's sort of like stabilising the business, and I think they have to a degree done a pretty good job of stabilising Tim. And actually, because let's be honest, it's been a bit of a poor telco when you look at former state monopolies that have sort of like gone on to dominate the industry. It's one of the poorest across Europe. And then, you know, so they stabilise the company. They've got a board with a dominant voice at the moment, which has a single strategy, which is saying, let's move forward and let's create this DigiTim, you know, this convergence model. But then at the same time, you've got Elliot coming in saying, right, we want you to scrap those six shareholders. Yeah. We want to put our shareholders on the board, which makes a completely dysfunctional boardroom.
Yeah.
Too many voices, everyone shouting to try and get across the voice sitting next to them. Is Amos Ganesh going to stick around there, or however you pronounce his name, I can't remember.
Yeah.
Is he going to stick around when that boardroom is an absolute bloody mess? Probably not, which means they've lost their third CEO in 18 months. Get their fourth one in, that creates an absolute disaster in the boardroom again. And then at the same time, if you look at the Elliott slate, they put six guys forward who were very competent businessmen, but they're competent businessmen from
other areas,
the noughties and the 90s. These are like 50-60-year-old guys. They're good. They're titans of industry, but they're not titans of technology and the digital industry. So, are these the guys? Are these dinosaurs going to take Tim forward?
They're all good questions. I'm going to start to wrap this one up just because we want to cover everything else before the batteries and Pierre's cameras die. my summary is it just comes over like a lot of corporate dicking about. Vivendi seems addicted to corporate dicking about. Elliot is a activist investor, so their sort of mission statement is corporate dicking about. And Tim's in the middle as this sort of hapless hot potato, as you put it, getting chucked about.
Yeah, and there's the Italian government worried about the infrastructure, I suppose.
So it's all a little bit of a mess. Okay, so we'll do that. Now, Ian.
I know,
they're sort of conspiring.
Jimmy has to go to the bathroom.
I want to go to the toilet. I'm going to be back in 2 minutes.
It's right, they do that Joe Rogan. They get people walking around.
I'll talk for ages then.
So what are we doing? Are we filling or are we cutting, Pierre?
We're
filling.
You can come back in and join in.
No time for that.
All right, and just make sure you go before we start next time, Jamie. Jamie, eh? What a... No.
Unbelievable.
ZTE and generally Chinese companies getting mucked about by Western politicians.
Yeah,
so remind us what some of the latest sort of grief that ZTE is having to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's both Huawei and ZTE, but very focused very much on ZTE this week because they've kind of been hit with a double whammy from the US and the UK, mainly the US, which has, I think, banned US component makers which supply ZTE from selling to it for 7 years.
7 years, which might as well be forever.
Yeah, exactly. And
it's not they're going to sit there and go, all right, that's fine.
Some of these companies are taking a massive hit as a result of that, like Acacia, I think it is. Share price down massively.
Jamie could tell you about the story he wrote on that very subject. Right, he could, but
he's going to miss out on doing
bladder.
That. The reason being apparently that US authorities have sort of discovered that ZTE's misled them essentially.
Yeah. Back in the days,
let's recap, they
were doing them for trading with Iran, which was on a banned list and putting. They were selling equipment
to Iran that included these components from US companies, which was prohibited.
Yeah.
And they supposedly cleaned up their act last year.
Yeah, and they fessed up. They paid a big fine,
I think about 900,000. What was it? No, it must have been more than that.
There was a big old fan, and they sort of said they'd fire a few people. The usual scapegoating presumably happened.
Exactly. And they claimed to put all these corporate governance procedures in place, had a big clean out. But the US has come out this week and said that it's found it was misled in some areas. I think Jamie was saying, I mean, he could clarify if he was in the room, but he's not. But I think he was saying that there's signs that they haven't got rid of some of the people they said they had. They've even paid them bonuses.
Yeah, indeed. Or if they paid them off, they paid them off pretty
heavily. I mean, I wonder if there's a suggestion in there that they've carried on selling. I haven't read that anywhere, but it seems like there's a kind of.
Do you guys ever watch Homeland?
I haven't watched Homeland.
But you know, it's about like CIA.
It's a bit like 24, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like the CIA terrorist stuff. And in the show, I don't remember which season.
Jamie's back with a spring in his step.
The terrorists actually use their T phones. If you freeze frame and zoom in, you can see that they use.
That's not a great bit of product placement for them.
See, it's been coming for years. When Homeland does something like that, you know that. Anyway, at the same time as this has been going on, the UK has done pretty much what the US did years ago, back in 2012, when a US government report first sort of cited ZTE and Huawei as potential security risks and said that they shouldn't be, you know, they kind of warned off the big operators from using them, operators that had dealings with the government, had government contracts, that were warned off using either of the Chinese suppliers. And the UK sort of cybersecurity authorities, part of GCHQ, have come out this week and kind of done the same thing. They've said that there's a risk of using, not they haven't mentioned Huawei, but they've said there's a risk of using ZTE equipment.
Slightly.
Right.
In that they said they have a team in GCHQ which monitors Huawei assets to say, to make sure there's no ill-gotten gains for the Chinese government. Then they turned around and said it's a massive risk because we don't have the resource to watch ZTE and Huawei.
So we've just been watching ZTE thoroughly, but we haven't got around to Huawei yet. Even though that's the one with all the contracts in the UK market, because ZTE apparently doesn't have.
That's what they're monitoring.
Keeping an eye on Huawei.
I mean, even though this is a setback for ZTE in terms of the direct loss from not being able to do business in the UK, if BT goes, right, we're going to cut these dealings that we've had with ZTE. Some analysts have said it's not that substantial because they don't have a very big presence, but they've certainly been trying to get into the UK market more.
But I wonder where it's not so much the sales that's a massive issue.
Well, it's reputation, isn't it?
Well, reputation and the disruption to their supply chain.
Yeah.
I mean, that's going to cause.
That's the US side of it.
Huge issues.
That's a much bigger problem, I would think.
Yeah, but. Massive. And I think that's part of the reason. Well, I mean, obviously their sales are going to be disrupted and part of the reason for the financial.
So we mentioned
that. Can they use Chinese component suppliers instead of. You know, I mean, presumably they'll have to. But
it's going to snowball, isn't it? Because this is what people always say about
US just doing a favour for Chinese component suppliers.
I think so, but
kicking its own ones in the.
The problem is, it's going to take time to set up those relationships. Yeah. So what does ZTE do in between getting ditched by the US and setting up these partnerships with Chinese companies?
Well, that's why they've suspended their financials and all that sort of thing.
But I just repeated something that you guys have said earlier.
No. I
didn't mention the suspension.
No, it was the story you wrote about the share price being indicator.
Yeah, okay. I'm caught up.
That's fine. And we cussed you for needing to go to the toilet, by the way, in case you're wondering.
Yeah. Talks about you mainly.
And what was I going to say? Yeah, so, you know, we've spoken about this before, but broader trade war stuff, it always ends up escalating. I mean, tit for tat and all that sort of thing. And yes, as you say, the unintended consequence might be to accelerate development of Chinese companies to do the stuff that they'd previously been reliant on US companies for.
Yeah. I mean, one of the areas that I just cannot see, I mean, talking about supply chains again, and this was back to an article about, I don't know if you guys read it, it was ages ago, and I think it was in Forbes, where some guy analysed how much the iPhone would cost if it was being manufactured in America. The States.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, there's going to be some
$5,000 per iPhone 10 or whatever.
More than that. Right. It was about, I think, if to maintain current levels of profitability because of the US doesn't have the actual workforce or the assets at the moment to manufacture the same scale as China, they would have to, I think they'd go from, you know, 300 million devices manufactured a month or however much it is, down to about a million. So they would have to charge between £30,000 and £100,000
just to make the same
unit to maintain profitability.
It'd be the '80s or
Oh yeah. I mean, it would be absurd. So how many American companies are dependent on Chinese manufacturing facilities? I mean, the retribution is going to come at some point, and maybe that's where the biggest damage is going to be.
Could well be. And that's
killing
what's so,
the supply chain.
That's what's so funny about the sort of economic nationalism that Trump comes out with is, you know, China has been the manufacturing engine of the world for decades.
Yeah.
That whole Hong Kong, Shenzhen bit. You know, just the other day, I was buying some stuff.
Suited everybody very nicely, yeah.
Yeah, buying some stuff for my kids, and I could tell that it was coming from China because it wasn't going to turn up for about a month. Yeah. So I'm going to stick it on a ship.
You get your cheap stuff and they get
jobs. Yeah, exactly. So there's a sort of exporting of deflation or exporting of cheap labour.
Yeah.
And, of course, we're all very happy to have this cheap labour when we can get all this groovy stuff.
Yeah.
Because, you know, some person's been working for next to nothing in China or Vietnam or whatever. And it is a bit hypocritical to then go on about economic sort of nationalism and then this sort of populist stuff. However, on the flip side, you know, there's plenty of evidence that they dick around with currency, that they steal intellectual property and all that sort of thing. So there is some stuff. There is some justification to it. But the long and short of it is China has made a point of being very good at manufacturing in a way that most Western countries haven't.
Yeah.
You know, there's some exceptions. Germany's good at like high value engineering and manufacturing and that sort of thing.
It's just silly things like, you know, they've got the opportunity to be that good. You know, minimum wage is lower in some of these countries because they don't have the rights. Well, they don't have the rights, but then at the same time, you know, you can attract an engineer over there, a senior engineer, let's say for £100,000, whereas his living expenses might be £60,000 over here. Living expenses in China are going to be, what, £20,000?
Well, quite.
Yeah, you know, it's
yeah,
just
so there's all sorts of factors at play. And you can't just suddenly say, right, we're going to start making stuff here. Because, as you say, the cost of producing it is so much higher. One thing, one last thing to talk about, a slightly more sort of positive note. Huawei had a big sort of analyst slash update for everyone over in aforementioned Shenzhen this week. And they were talking about 5G. There were a couple of things. We weren't there, but we had Robert from Light Reading over there, didn't we?
Yeah.
And I spoke to a former colleague of mine who's an analyst at a company called Counterpoint now.
Yeah.
And he sort of gave me, he was like my ad hoc sort of field reporter and gave me the lowdown. And basically, yeah, just lots of positive stuff regarding 5G coming from them. They were downplaying the immediate, you know, as a lot of people have done. They were going, you know, they get too carried away right now.
Yeah.
And a few people, you know, I think Robert sort of touched on that slightly more sort of downbeat, and some other journalists ran with it more. But my mate Neil was more like, no, they were just being sensible.
Yeah.
They were just going, look, this isn't going to happen overnight. But at the same time, you know, they're so diversified. They've got. So
I think that's the thing, though, isn't it? It's quite odd in a way to hear a company, because they were quite, I don't know if the word negative's right, but they really did sort of downplay the attractions of 5G.
Yeah.
And that's very much a contrast with what Ericsson seems to be doing.
Yeah.
And that's because they're just so much more reliant on that, aren't they, than Huawei.
Yeah, they're all in, aren't they?
They're all in. 5G is like their future. And
Huawei's,
you know,
got
and Huawei's for Huawei, it's just a small part of what it does. I mean, I think they've announced this R&D goal of like spending between 10 and 20 billion every year.
Right.
Which, for one thing, is massive compared to what Nokia and Ericsson is spending. I think they're each spending about 5 billion.
Mm. Right.
But only
well, they've got more money.
They've only
they?
Said that 800 million of that's going on 5G, you know,
right,
which is quite a small percentage of the overall figure, and it kind of shows the kind of diversity of the product line.
Well, I was struck when I was talking to my mate Neil about how good they are at chips now.
Yeah.
So they've had the, you know, they've been making their own SoCs for their sort of application processors for a little while, and that's not that amazing because Samsung does its own, Apple does its own. A few others, so that's been a growing thing. But I didn't realise how competitive they were on modems. You know, so apparently, you know, they're expecting to launch a smartphone in the second half of next year with their own 5G modem. And I thought, Qualcomm was absolutely miles ahead of everyone else on that.
Yeah.
But it looks like people like them and Samsung have caught up quite nicely.
So are they aiming to have like one of the first smartphones?
I think
in
so,
the market?
Yeah.
Huawei, is that the big goal? To
I think so. I mean, there was some talk. I think Qualcomm's saying that its chip will be commercially available at the beginning of next year.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it's going to appear in phones straight away. So I think there's going to be a bit of a race, you know, for the kudos of coming out with the first 5G phone towards the end of 2019.
Do you think people in Peterborough will buy it?
I bet they will.
Jamie, what do you think people in Peterborough think about 5G?
Wow. To be perfectly honest, I mean, no one's really mentioned it to me, so I can't imagine we've got many listeners in Peterborough, to be honest.
No one's hassled you about slagging him off last week?
No. No one's mentioned that.
Oh, by the way, we have one listener in Guam. I just want to say hi if he's listening today. Yeah.
My son says that 6G is coming out because he saw 6G written on a case in one of those like Indian sort of mobile phone shops. So
5G is already just old news. Okay.
6G's around the corner.
I think the battery light is starting to flash on that camera. I will move on to the last thing. Just taking more sort of digital economy. Amazon came out with some information today it doesn't normally do in its quarterlies. This is a sort of in advance of its quarterlies, about a week in advance. It started talking about certain parts of its business and how they're doing. And I think the headline figure was that Amazon Prime, which to anyone who doesn't know is a subscription service Amazon where you get expedited delivery, but all sorts of other bits and bobs like video on demand, like Amazon Music and other stuff. And it said it's got over 100 million subscribers worldwide. So I'm not sure. I'm a subscriber. I pay, I don't know, £8 a month, something like that. That sounds about right.
How many has Netflix got out of interest to its video service?
I don't know off the top of my head.
I thought it was 52 million subscribers.
No, more than
Netflix.
That.
Yeah, wasn't it?
Netflix,
must
no,
be more.
Way more than that. I've got, for some reason, 300 million in my head. I seem to remember reading something.
Carry on, I'll just...
Why don't you look it up while you're on your phone?
You can be Jamie.
Be a research guy.
Yeah, you can be Jamie off Joe Rogan looking that stuff up. We should have a little screen. Anyway, but talking
not,
about Jamie...
Not exactly the same thing, obviously, are they? Because Prime's like a sort of free grocery service.
Yeah, and the VOD is just one part of it. But, you know, having introduced it, I'll hand it over to our official Jamie, because you were writing about that today as well.
125,
yeah.
So oh, they're both looking off. It up. It was a race. You both got there exactly
the same
time.
They're quite similar numbers.
So you were, I was slightly closer.
So what's going on with Amazon, Jamie, on top of all that stuff I just blurted out?
No, I mean, it's just, he came out and he just said, Prime, it's usually quite a cagey thing for Bezos. He doesn't like revealing more than he actually has to. And my theory is that something's going to happen next week. So he's sort of like, he's put this letter out to shareholders saying, look, we've got 100 million Prime subscribers now. Isn't it great, all these things that we've been doing over the last decades to build the Prime proposition?
And he's sort of bigging up their investment record and that sort of thing, isn't he?
Because he spent a shitload on Prime. And the amount of things you can get for it, especially in the US, is absolutely incredible. So he's been building up this idea of, you know, the Amazon business model, it's long-term investment. We never get things right in the first. He used a handstand sort of like story to say, you know, if you plan to do a handstand in 2 weeks, you will fail. You will give up. You have to plan to do a handstand in 6 months, which
I
was.
Don't even want to think about me trying to do a handstand
or 30 years.
Yeah. So he's just
call
been
the fire
saying,
brigade if I tried that. I think.
So he's just been saying, you know, keep going.
Right.
With this is long term. And it comes a week ahead of their financial results. So he's building the idea in his head, in investors' heads and shareholders' heads. This is how we do business. This is why we're great at business.
Yeah.
Because I think something's going to happen next week.
So what I would imagine will happen, so what the picture you're painting seems to be him saying to investors, you know, if we splash a lot of money on investment, it always pays off in the end, which would seem to me to imply that he might announce another big bit of M&A or another big load of money spending on something.
I mean, it could be underperformance for the quarter as well. He could be saying, look, you know, our objective is long term,
so
not short term.
Chill if next
if
week's
it's not
shit.
As good, don't worry, we don't plan for the next quarter, we plan for 15-20.
Yeah, it
15,
sounds like
you
might be trying to get expectations down because numbers aren't perhaps as
okay.
great as...
If they have 100 million subscribers...
I have no idea what they're expecting, by the way.
That's $10 billion every year.
Right, okay. Just straight up.
And then Amazon and Netflix, well, what it's are there like 12.5, so...
Yeah.
What but are their annual revenues, Amazon?
170 something billion.
But they're not very profitable.
No,
are they?
Exactly. No, their margins compared billion. To people like, I mean, Apple's the margin king.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But their margins are still, their margins are still worse than the sort of ad-led like big internet players like Google and Facebook, I think. Is that right?
But even yeah. I mean, in terms of the profitability, because it is just passing from, a lot of it passing money from one person to another, mm-hmm. really, isn't it? And taking a little slice with their e-commerce. But I think it was something like 170 billion operating profit of something like 4.1 billion. But then they haven't paid a dividend for God knows how long, so they reinvest everything.
Yeah, they spend too much on cardboard.
Yeah, it's a Ponzi scheme.
I mean, they've got a massive number of employees, haven't they, to those other companies?
Like 500,000.
Kind of a bricks and mortar business. Like unlike
they have to have sort of dudes in the warehouses. Sort of
well, there's more robots all the time.
But I read somewhere that the warehouse conditions are horrible.
Yeah,
some guy went undercover and he said it was like a prison.
They said there was a report in the Evening Standard a couple of days ago where people are taking bottles into the fulfillment centres because it takes 10 minutes to get to the toilets. You have to go through airport style security.
Yeah, I think
10 minutes to get back.
UK sports chain, wasn't the stories about
JD Sports?
Sports Direct. Was it Sports Direct where people
Mike
were coming
Ashley.
Out with stories about things like that?
Which, let me just stick a great big alleged before all of that in case any of them freak out. But yeah, I think I've read stuff about that extreme micromanagement. So like, you know, your repetitive tasks per second almost is tracked. And it's also logged if you start slacking off. So that's probably where this slashing in a bottle stuff.
Yeah, well,
which incidentally you might consider, Jamie.
Which is, no, but that's part of what they said. They said it takes 20 minutes to do a round trip to the toilet because they're so secure. They have like airport style security that is like, well, I could get disciplined or lose my job, but if I go to the toilet three times a day, that's an hour out of my working day. So
that's how they get so good at getting stuff to the door.
Yeah.
The next
and that's
day.
A bit heavy. And for us as consumers of it, it's similar to the sort of, Far Eastern cheap labor model. We were going, oh, isn't that cool? Look, I can get this thing that I just impulse purchased turn up tomorrow. And of course, you know, I'm not going to beat myself up over the fact that someone might have had to slash in a bottle in order to get me that package so quickly. But, you know, that is the reality. If you're going to be more and more competitive, you kind of have to increase productivity and all that sort of thing. And something's got to give. Cool. All right. Well, I think we've done that. Talking about increased productivity, I think we've been quite productive enough for one podcast. And I think the battery in that camera has been pretty productive as well.
Yeah.
So,
made in China.
So thanks a lot guys, and thanks a lot for listening. Make sure you join us for the next one.